You're listening to WWBC Coco, Melbourne, Titusville, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI, Coco, Rockledge, and W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, and 100.7 FM.
Hello, Space and Treasure Coast. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. We are heard on AM 1510 WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online everywhere on God's magnificent planet.
That's right. On 1510wwbc.com, you can get all of our information there, as well as all of the show archives. Just pick by date, and then we share them there on our website and social media channels, which is SitaMediaInc.com. Of course, you can always listen live right from that radio station dial, 1510 WWBC. Just hit the Listen Live button, and you'll get us on any one of your streaming devices.
My daughter actually said you could ask Alexa to play Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, and they play it live.
You can, I know. It's so cool.
I know. I did that in L.A. last week. It was so cool. So for our listeners who are tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends for the first time today, on Mondays from 1 to 2 for the past 15 years, it's hard to believe.
It is.
Only thing I can see is gray hair.
On everybody
Ellen,
but you.
That's right. Ellen O'Neill, my co-host, and I have been hosting this show called Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. And now we have Allie, who is a friend of our show and fills in sometime for Ellen, Allie Tambor. Danny Whiting runs our board. And, you know, we just talk about kitchen table topics. We talk about things that are going on around the state, the nation, the world, people who are doing great things for the United States, for God's children, no matter where we live. We have a lot of people that want to talk about their nonprofits. People want to come in and speak about banking industry, education, politicians. I spoke to the David Jolly campaign this morning. I'll have him on next year. He's running for governor. I spoke to Anna Ishkamani. She'll be coming on to speak about running for mayor in this great city of Orlando. You know, I've spoken to people who want to come and talk about the homeless situation, lack of food, water, shelter in certain areas. And today's no different. I go about, and Ellen, you and I both, and all of us, we market a show. We talk to people who can come on as potential guests and help us sponsor a program so we could stay on air. And I think it's a wonderful way to keep up with community radio,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
So, of course, you know, I met this wonderful gentleman, I want to say 15, 20 years ago, Mr. Radwan Chowdhury. And I've postponed him a couple of times because we've had other guests that wanted to come on, but I was able to lock the date in today, and he's calling in. He's on the phone. He's going to speak about the Udeon Foundation, and I know, Ellen, you know all about that.
Yes.
It's a foundation that was founded by Radwan, and it's in a response to the global crisis facing, you know, just poverty. And he was inspired by the way he was raised, by his peers, to give back. And so he founded this wonderful charity. And it's all about the children, right? The impoverished children all over the world. And that's what he does. So he's going to talk to us in a minute. Our second segment, as you know, I went to Los Angeles and my son took me to a place called The Brewery. And they had an art show. And I ran into a gentleman who happens to be a Venezuelan American. He's a multimedia artist, a writer, and an educator. He's going to be calling in from California to speak his heart out about why he thinks there should be change in Venezuela, and it should be a country that, you know, everyone has support, food, education, opportunities. And, you know, I wouldn't say want to make it regime change, but he's supporting the United States, and so am I, in their bid to see what we can do to bring democracy to Venezuela.
Yeah, and he's got an ongoing series, Los Imagineros, something along those lines. Yeah.
Well, when you are from Trinidad and Tobago, as I am, and you see the influx of Venezuelans that are coming to Trinidad, because our country is only 7 miles away, you understand the infrastructure, the healthcare system, the education system that's being burdened by people who are fleeing their homeland because their country is unstable. So the instability and the insecurity there is causing a lot of people to flee to adjoining islands, you know, islands in that hemisphere. So we'll see what happens with that second segment. But yes, for now, let's go to Radwan Chowdhury and speak to him a little bit about the UDN Foundation, and he'll bring us up to speed about the global crisis and poverty facing people, not just here in the United States, but worldwide. So, Radwan, thank you for taking the time to call in on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you, and welcome to all of you viewers, and thank you for joining us. So, I'm excited, and as you know, you and I often talk, and all the issues that are going on around the world, and we all have an opportunity to chime in any way we possibly can. Of course, none of us have the ability to do everything, but all of us can do a little bit to help the country that we found or the world that we born into to make it better. So thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, and I love, you know, with you, one of the things that you and I met so long ago when we were so... We were younger and bolder, and we could do so much for the Democratic Party, and we could do so much for other people. But we've all evolved, and we're watching what's happening with the world, not just in the United States, but in all countries. No one would have anticipated what happened in the Middle East and all that. But I love that your mission is to end poverty, and you focus so much on the orphanages and the children who are left behind. And that really endeared you to me, because I think we should leave the world a better place than we found it. So you've become everybody's aunt and uncle and neighbor and friend and grandma and everything else to those children. So talk to our listeners a little bit about your foundation and why you founded it.
So again, thank you. It's wonderful to see those individuals, those children who are on the street, and with a little help that I can possibly do to give them a little bit of comfort and a little bit of support. The reason I found it, you know, when I grew up in a very Bangladesh is a poor country. It is a growing country economically, but when I came to this country and I saw the world in a different perspective, I saw that there should be no reason that children should pick up a food off the drainage or sewage to feed themselves. And of course, as I said, you know, I don't have the ability to solve all the problem in the world or all the problem specifically in Bangladesh. But if I can help as many as I can, that will give me the comfort, that will give me the satisfaction that yes, you know, I try best of my ability. I try to lend my hand. So from that perspective, when I went, first time I went back home, I saw a very young girl picking up food off the sewer line and eating it, basically just washing it with her hand and a little bit of water that she could, and eating that food. And I was like watching her that this is not right. This is not the way it should be. And of course, I saw that before I came to this country, but it would never click in my mind or occur to me that this is not normal. This is completely unusual. So when I went back for the first time, I said, no, this is not acceptable. What can I do to, you know, help? And that is the starting point. And then I started sponsoring their child. And then from that point, it's no returning. So I continued the process. I gather my friends and family that I grew up with in Bangladesh and convince them that this is what we want to do. We want to help as many as we can, and I'll be in front line, which you support me in the process. And They all agreed, and we started the process from that point, and I expanded the program. One of the programs that I'm so proud at this moment, that we're not only, you know, we have saying that you don't give them the fish, you give them how to fish.
Yes.
So what we try to do now, we're trying to give them a trade-based training. So one of the training that we're doing, as I'm the technologist, we provide a soft skill for designing, like business cards, flyers, or, you know, posters on online, and try to help them create an account on outsourcing platform like, you know, Cyber or Workout. And those platforms, they're able to create somebody's flyer or design a poster or banner and be able to earn $5, $10 for each of those projects that takes about 30 to 40 minutes. But that $5 convert or $10 convert in Bangladesh to a decent amount of 1,000 taka. So that program is extremely successful. We'll be able to have about, I think right now, over 75 children. They were working in somebody's daily shop for a very nominal amount, now be able to subsidize their family's income and uplift their family. They don't have to work on the street any longer.
Yeah.
So that is the program we are doing right now. I'm so proud of that program with all the people that are helping me.
Yeah, that's a lot of progress you're making there. And so these children that you help, are they in orphanages, or do they have parents, or the working poor? How do you find the kids to help, and who refers them to the UDN Foundation?
So it's the first part of the question, answer both. There are many, they are in orphanage. There I have linked up with 5 orphanages throughout the country. And also many of them are their home with their family, but they don't have enough resources to go to the school or, you know, feed themselves 3 times a day. So we subsidize combination of both of those. Most of the referral comes through the community. So I have network of people in place, and they're all volunteers. We don't pay anybody to do any of this work. And they come and they vet them. Local people, they will vet them to make sure, you know, they are what they're saying they are, and they are household income. They go talk to their family members and parents. If they are orphan, then they talk to the extended family, and then we refer them to the orphanage and we subsidize orphanage for that. So a combination of collective of good people working in harmony.
Yeah. And I notice your foundation focuses a lot on the environment. And because you have cyclones over there, you have a lot of floods, you have a lot of areas where it's hard hit when there is inclement weather. So talk to us a little bit about, because I know we have spoken before about the Rohingya Muslims too. They live in tents. Yeah. A lot of them don't even have food, water, shelter, a blanket. And you couple that up with the weather, and then it becomes a very challenging situation for those people.
Extremely, extremely. Over 70% of the country is below the sea level in Bangladesh. So that's a huge number. And also, you know, almost half of the country is the rivers and waters and oceans. So it is on top of that, it's a very dense country, as you said. It's highly populated, over 170 million people, extremely dense country. It is a very extremely challenging, though, for specifically Rohingya. There are many nonprofit organizations throughout the world are supporting, helping, but it's just not enough. Same way as Gaza, right? Irrespective of how much support you do, there is still not enough because it's number of people and the location and all that. We have provided some training in the natural disaster. I was able to work with the United Nations, and there is an organization called IMO, International Migration Organization, directly chartered by United Nations. And I was able to partner with them from UDN Foundation and took a team from here to Bangladesh who are experts in emergency shelter. And we provided over 1,600 people in 3 parts of the country are really high risk in flood and all those, what to do in the natural disaster, how to prevent it, to save their lives, first and foremost. And in the event that happens, how to build a temporary shelter for them away from the disaster area. And of course, that comes along with the support from other nonprofit organizations, the government, everything. So we kind of channel a link. In the event when it happens, we do activate our volunteers to go immediately to provide and some immediate food and water and nutrition and medicine. That's an immediate. And then in the long run, we connect with them right appropriate organization and the government entity to help them with rebuild their temporary shelter until they have their permanent shelter rebuilt.
Yeah, because, you know, like in the United States, you know, we get a text or an email or something when there's a storm coming or something about disaster, you know, preparedness responses, recovery, you know, and where to go, shelters and all that. And I don't think a lot of Americans understand that in these countries like Bangladesh and India and different countries, there is no such thing. I mean, as much as the government wants to help, they don't have the technology like we do. Like I would get a text, the shelters are going to be open in Titusville or Melbourne because the weather is going to drop under 60. But talk to our listeners a little bit about, you know, people say, well, why can't the governments in those countries help the way our Brevard County, Florida is helping the Brevard County residents? But I don't think that they're capable because there's so many people.
Yes. So the government just don't have the enough resources. And it is a developing country. So there is a cost associated. There is so much more involved than just because the United States or other country, they don't have system in place. And like Bangladesh or Nepal or surrounding developing countries don't have that process in place. And government tried initially. They do have I would say they have progress, made a progress in that aspect, but not in the context of like we do here. Like you said, we receive a text for warning. You can subscribe to many different alerts, but Bangladesh does not have that process in place. They do have a national weather channel where people can watch, but half of the country goes dark when the natural disaster takes place because there is no electricity and there is no alternative power system. So, you know, in order for you to get even news or anything, your satellite, your network system goes down. So there is no cell phone services. Your electricity goes off. So those are some challenges that government has to overcome and hopefully, you know, slowly but surely.
Yeah, because, you know, the argument is right when, you know, and for our listeners who are tuning into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, we're speaking with Mr. Radwan Chowdhury. He's the CEO or CFO. Director? What is your title there?
Chief Operating Officer.
I was close. That's everything. You're like everything to this foundation. And I just appreciate so much what you do. The UDN Foundation is a globally focused charity organization that works to improve the health and well-being of children living in the poverty in underdeveloped nations through the use of innovation, effective measurable programs and equitable resources. But here's the thing, I was speaking to someone and they're like, well, why don't you the Indian people channel your resources into helping Americans? And then I say to them that the poorest American sometimes is probably comparable to like the richest one over there in Bangladesh or India or Trinidad, because, you know, I look at my own children and my grandkids, it's easy to pull up to a McDonald's and spend $20 on a Happy Meal and a chocolate drink and, you know, an extra set of fries. But that $20 in Bangladesh or a developing country is like the whole 6 months of salary. Am I correct?
Absolutely. To give you one quick example, I have a program called Conditional Cash Transfer. And those programs are specifically designed for children, underage children that work in a grocery store, on a tea shop, for 1,000 or 1,500 taka in Bangladesh. 1,500 taka equals to about $11 in the US. Like you said, and not even a combo meal in McDonald's. And that is a full month salary for one child. So we have that program, but because it's a cash money, our program is very limited and we have a long waiting list. We specifically go to those children and families saying that, okay, your child is not going to school because he's working or she's working in this grocery store making how much? 1,200, 1,300 taka a month. In a whole month, 1,200, 1,300 taka, which is equals to $10 to $11 a month.
Yeah, and these are children who would never see air conditioning. They would never see a bus with air conditioning to take them to school. They probably wouldn't have a desk to sit on. And I try to tell people all the time, it is our inherent responsibility to look out for children, not just here, but kind of like what Miss Rachel is doing for the children of Gaza. You have to love the children. So, you know, oftentimes you hear people say, well, you know, Indians came to America or Asians are here and, you know, we have all these resources and we're giving back. And, you know, we had one guy here in the Palm Bay City Council who asked for all Indians to be deported on his birthday. So talk to our listeners a little bit politically. I mean, people immigrate to the United States, of course, legal immigration. But the $100 or the $200 or the $50 that you send back home, it means so much to the families that you left behind. And sometimes it's not really a blood relative, but by giving back to the places that you left, you have become sort of an ambassador for that nation that you left. So when people say, you know, you should go back, you know, by working in the United States and contributing and paying our taxes and being good citizens, we are able to help the world and help other people as well.
Absolutely. We are making the world a better place than we born into. Absolutely. No question about it. Irrespective of, like you said, children in Gaza or children in Ukraine or children in Jerusalem, it does not matter. Children, and irrespective of what is your religious viewpoint, right?
Yeah.
You helping them, human being, a fellow human being, a child, you know, any parts of the world that you possibly can. And we often do some of those things. You have to have a connection. I cannot do this. To give an example, I don't have any connection in Gaza, and we know there are issues. I know I don't have any connection in Syria. I know there are children suffering. So only way for me to help those people is supporting other organizations who is doing the work in Ground Zero. So same way, I have connection in Bangladesh because I grew up in there, and I'm helping children in Bangladesh. That does not mean that children in Syria, Gaza, or Ukraine, or any other political area where, you know, children are suffering doesn't deserve it. I absolutely do, including here in the United States. We do. To answer your question and also for you, listeners, we do have a mentorship program in the U.S. through the UN Foundation. We mentor children. They are involved in substance uses, mostly in rural area, and we mentor them to have a better life. We bring them to our offices, and we, you know, have lunch with them once a month. And we talk to them, you know, if they, what they're doing, if they leave that and have a better life, they could be one day and see what other people are doing.
Right.
So we do have a mentorship program here as well.
Thank you. And, you know, one of the biggest challenges I see today is how to fight anti-Semitism, Hindu phobia, Islamophobia, you know, because at the end of the day, everybody wants to be loved and appreciated. Everyone wants food, water, shelter, freedom to speak, freedom to practice their religion. And, you know, whether you love Jesus or Buddha or you're Allah or whoever, Jehovah, whatever, it seems to me as though right now a lot of people don't take the time to get to know Muslim people, but they're quick to write something on social media about terrorism and be careful, especially when Zohran Mamdani got elected in New York. I saw so much Islamophobia. And you're Muslim. I have Muslim relatives. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about why they should not fear a person such as yourself who has such a good heart, and that in addition to doing your regular job, you are having this foundation? So talk to our listeners a little bit how we could stop people from thinking these horrible things about other cultures and other people.
I think it's very simple. You look at a person who they are, not what their religious view or how they look like. irrespective of my skin color, your skin color, or somebody else's skin color. We happen to be born and raised with a different culture in different parts of the world. End of the day, all 7.8 billion people in the world are all human beings. So if you look at it simply, oh, that's just another human being, happens to born from other parts of the world, happens to have a different faith, and happens to look like different, talk with the accent, but end of the day, he or she is a good-hearted human being who is willing and able or can do everything within him or his or her power to help another mankind. And if we simply can do one single thing, I think the world would be a much better place. But unfortunately, we have so much hatred in our heart because, you know, Bin Laden blew up the world, or somebody else, Timothy McGovern, blew up the IRS building. And we tend to bring the entire religion under one person's saying that, oh, entire religion is bad. All the people are in the world who believes, you know, Islam are terrorists, or all the people who is Hindu are bad people, or all the people are Christian because Timothy is blow up the IRS building. That mentality needs to change. We need to have that conversation in our kitchen table with our children and with our family, that an individual who looks different does not mean he or she is a bad person.
Right.
They happen to have different skin color, but that's all.
Right. And who do you, like, you know, I've always said that the Democratic Party needs to do less with the culture wars and focus on the economy. And right now, it's a very fractured Democratic Party. And I know you have been involved with the party for a long time. Who do you see as future leaders? Because the more people hear about a democratic socialist who promotes food, water, shelter, good roads, law enforcement, teachers, jobs, trade, people are saying, wait a minute, maybe we need to promote this a little bit more, because it doesn't mean that people are going to take your entire paycheck. It just says if you make a lot of money and you're a billionaire or millionaire and you pay a little bit more for the people who are helping you to become richer, it's okay. So who do you see as a rising star in the Democratic Party?
Well, I mean, if you want to just talk about it, I think three individuals are rise up, but to address the socialist or socialism, you know, the labeling, like you said, Jahran Mandami, mayor-elect in New York, is a socialist. And again, what does socialist mean? What exactly he's proposing? The basic needs of citizens of his, you know, in New York, or if you talk about Bernie Sanders, another socialist, or AOC, they all talk about the basic needs for, you know, citizens of this country. They are not talking about, like you said, taking out. And everyone that I named or any other who considered them as a socialist, they are only talking about people who making over $1 million or $2 million. So 90% of the country's population will not be impacted or affected by that taxation. It's only the 10% who's making. If I'm making over $1 million a year, I don't mind giving another extra $10,000 or extra $50,000.
Yeah, that's a great thing. If God bless you and you're able to make that much, then give a little bit more. At the end of the day, you sleep better at night. You're not going to take it in your grave or to the crematorium when you leave the planet, you know? So we have one last question for you before you go off air. So tell us how we can be part of the UDN Foundation, how someone could give us your website. And tell us again your mission statement, if you don't mind.
Sure. So very simple. You can go to www.udyamfoundation.org. That is, our website has all the information that you need, and that also link to donation site. You can donate to our cause. And our missions are very, very simple. We have one simple mission, to help people, and that is any way you possibly can. And we don't really solicit funding from other than family and friends. And our mission is simple, implement perpetual solutions to end the cycle of poverty, hunger, and social injustice. That is our mission. And again, that does not mean that I have the ability to solve all the problem in the world. But if I can solve one person's problem, I sleep better.
But sometimes it sets a protocol, too.
Yes. And I'm sorry?
I said sometimes it sets a protocol, too, of how others can continue the work, because you already lay the foundation of how it can be, how it can be solved. So in essence, you may be solving the world's problems.
Yeah. So really quick, and I know besides the UDN Foundation, you also tell our listeners a little bit about the actual, you have an actual day job too.
I do. I'm a technologist, so I consult with the federal government for technology, from cybersecurity to AI innovations to updating their aging software. So that's my day job. I am a father of two children, beautiful children, 8 years and a 5 years old. So my hands are full. In addition, I also served as a volunteer to Montgomery County, where I reside right now, as a citizen advisory board, chair of the board, and their Vision 2050 of Montgomery. I serve on that board as well.
Yeah, well, and I know that, you know, having children in the United States now, you know, in the current state of things, us Indian people, brown people, have to have that talk with their children now, how to be careful, watch what they say. I mean, it's scary what's going on with the immigration, what's going on with immigrants too.
Extremely, extremely dangerous what's going on. And yes, the conversation every day have to have in your kitchen table about the immigration, about how the society is. To make sure that they are safe and also they understand in the event if any of those incidents happens, what they need to do.
Right. And we have to teach them to love themselves, and no matter what, they belong on God's magnificent planet.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again so much for joining us. We've loved all the interviews that we've done with you, and we're certainly excited and proud to share the Odomi Project with all of our listeners. We are going to take a quick break and listen to our sponsors, and we'll be right back with Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right after these messages.
Cloud 9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. The delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture. 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at cloud9, that's cloud9, furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture. Located in Titusville, Florida, Dixie Crossroads has been serving great-tasting seafood, char-grilled steaks, prime rib, chicken, fresh salads, and their famous corn fritters for over 31 years. The menu features the very best local shrimp and fish from Port Canaveral and ranges from low-cost sandwiches and baskets to high-end seafood combos. Visit this Florida favorite at 1475 Garden Street in Titusville. That's Dixie Crossroads, 321-268-5000, 321-268-5000, or visit them on the web at dixiecrossroads.com. Jotkoff Financial Group is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships with clients. Jotkoff Financial Group can assist you in meeting your accounting, tax, and business consulting and financial planning and insurance needs without expanding your internal workforce. With three locations here in Florida, here in Brevard County, Broward County, and Nassau County, contact Jotkoff Financial Group here in Brevard at 321-984-7345, located at 1122 South Wickham Road in Melbourne. That's Jotkoff Financial Group. On the web, you'll find them at www.jotkoff.com. Call the professionals at Jotkoff Financial Group today.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. What a great first segment we had, Ellen, with our friend Radwan Chowdhury.
Every time he's on with us, I always learn something new. And because he's from Bangladesh and he really kind of paints the picture of what it's, you know, not that we don't have other people that paint the image of what it's like to be an immigrant in this country, but he also reaches out to help, you know, other countries and other people. So it's just amazing.
Right.
Just amazing, amazing man.
Thank you. So for our listeners who are tuning in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, we are heard on AM 1510, WWBC, FM 94.7, 99.9, 100.7, and online everywhere on WWBC.
That's right. You can just hit that listen live button on that website and you can get us on any one of your streaming devices. And then, of course, we share all of that on our social media as well as our website, which is cedamediainc.com.
Right. So our first guest was, we learned a lot about, and you know, that's the thing about immigration. You know, people don't think about it, but when you immigrate to the United States legally and you have a job where you could give, you know, maybe $10, $15, $100, whatever you can to the countries that are developing like Bangladesh, and you know what happens when there's a cyclone, when there are rains, when there are floods, and you see the families that are struggling just to stay afloat, you don't mind people coming here and giving back.
That's right.
And I think this is why it's good to have shows such as ours that showcases not just what's happening in the United States, but around the world. We are supposed to care about the world.
That's right.
And our second guest, you know, I went to L.A. and my son took me to the brewery and I met a very wonderful, nice gentleman who is a Venezuelan-American. And, of course, you know, me being from Trinidad, which is 7 miles away from Venezuela, I struck up a conversation with him. His name is Juan Herrera, and he is a multimedia artist, a writer, and an educator. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about why he thinks Venezuela should be a country that works for all, not just some. Yeah. And I think he's on the phone. So, hello, Juan. Are you on the phone?
Yeah.
Well,
hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. I'm hearing a lot of little scraggly noises.
Yeah, make sure your radio's turned off in the background.
Yeah, so, you know, you and I talked a little bit about the United States throwing their support to help Venezuela and most of their concerns about humanitarian concerns, the restoration of democracy. And, you know, we have to be focused on what's going on there because there are people that are leaving. There's a humanitarian crisis. Venezuelans are leaving every day to go to countries because they want a better life. They want an opportunity. They're leaving friends and family behind to go to countries, welcome or unwelcome, illegal or illegal, and it's causing a lot of chaos there. So talk to us a little bit about yourself, first to begin with, and how you got involved in wanting a free Venezuela as well.
Well, I would start with the fact that I'm a visual artist that works on memory, on the identity and community. So my work usually pulls from my cultural background and what I'm living personally. And, you know, I was one of the Venezuelans that left Venezuela before the crisis was, you know, severe. I came to the States to study, to do my PhD, my MFA, and become a educator here in the United States. And I always, in my experience, you know, in University of Iowa, and CalArts and, you know, the Chicago Art Institute, always saw democracy and art very entangled and very, very much part of the same ecosystem. Democracy cannot be full and vigorous without art. And art strives in democratic systems. So it's a complement.
Yeah. You wear many hats, my friend. You wear a lot of hats. And I'm so proud that I ran into you and I met you, because your bio is extensive. What you want for the world is just like all of us, to leave a good planet behind. And you're doing it through your art and expression and the creativity that you have.
Yes, absolutely. I usually like the diaspora, for example, of Venezuelans around the world, as you mentioned, has increased. And part of my art has, you know, been influenced by that that diaspora and that nation building outside of Venezuela, because that's part of what, as Venezuelans and Venezuelan Americans, we have in this period of time have to learn that. Part of the national identity, part of our internal balance or stability, is dependent on what our communities as in the diaspora are able to do, communicate, and you know, negotiate with their own, you know, double presence, their double nationalities, their double cultures.
Yeah. And you have used art to show the Venezuelan currency, which was forbidden. Talk to us a little bit about how you, the messages you were trying to convey with that piece of art.
Yes. And yes, you're referring to a series that I titled the Los Imaginarios de la Identidad, or the Imaginaries of Identity. And it's a combination of the currency with a photojournalism that was done in Venezuela, but that was not able to be seen in Venezuela due to the fact that the circulation of images now through the internet can be censored. For example, we had during the you know, the periods of time in which Venezuela had a lot of internal struggle and marches and you know, like confronting of the dictatorship, we had a lot of photojournalism being done by, you know, in New York Times and other, you know, outlets. And those photos were, in most cases, never seen inside of Venezuela, because now you can just, you know, block images or block publications in certain geographical areas. So the government had censored a lot of these photos in Venezuela. So this Venezuelans were not able to see a lot of what was happening inside of Venezuela. So I grabbed those images and combined it in collages, large scale collages that utilize high resolution scans of the currencies. So it was a combination of the two, and it was to criticize exactly the circulation of images and the circulation of money, because in that time we had like a hyperinflation that got to 10,000% or over 1,000,000% at one point in Venezuela.
Yeah, and I like that you use art instead of traditional journalism to get the word out, to show people what's going on. Because, you know, oftentimes you hear people say, well, why is the United States showing such a force right now towards Venezuela. But when you speak to Venezuelan citizens who are living here in the United States, like, for example, I have someone who does my facials, and she was a dentist in Venezuela, and she wants to practice dentistry. She was an oral surgeon, but she fled because, like you said, a box of cereal is maybe 10 to 15 bucks. You know, toothpaste, you know, soap, shampoo, just regular things and basic necessities, the prices are so high. So when you talk to people and they tell you why you flee now, people are wondering what's happening. Talk to us a little bit about one of the major, what are the major reasons that people have fled? I mean, the economy is one, but they also, the democracy fell so badly that people have no, they have no right, they cannot express themselves at all.
Yes, and I would say that it has been a progressive type of decline. And this is not like just a couple of years ago. This is like 30 years, 40 years in decline. And it has gotten certainly worse right now, and it cannot be sustained. Venezuela has had a systemic problem, which is that we did not get to democracy in a regular way. We didn't get to democracy through you know, political discourse or political negotiations, let's say, and we didn't establish a country through like a consensus of what we wanted for a country. When petroleum in Venezuela is as most of your listeners probably know, Venezuela is a very rich country in terms of resources. It has the biggest reserves of petroleum in the world. The petroleum industry started in Venezuela in 1912, you know, just after it started in the United States. So we have, you know, resources, and Venezuela was always a stable economy and a stable nation, a republic, let's say, a republic that was governed sometimes by dictators, but it was always governed by petroleum as a resource. So democracy, when it got to Venezuela, it got through also petroleum, and we didn't settle the political part. We didn't establish what we wanted politically, and right now we're seeing the consequences. We're seeing, you know, internal struggle. We're seeing extremes being expressed, like extreme right, extreme left.
Yeah, like we have. I mean, that's happening all over the world, yeah, with this extreme right, yeah, and left. But, you know, I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago, and I remember the days when Venezuela was just a thriving country, that all of us young Indian girls wanted to go to Venezuela and marry a Venezuelan guy and stay in Venezuela because they used to come to shop in Trinidad and they were doing so well. And then all of a sudden we started hearing about the presence and the influence of the United States adversaries like the Russians and China and in Venezuela. Yeah. And we heard about, then, you know, there was so much geopolitical concerns now, but as a young girl, nobody was paying attention to that. And then all of a sudden you fast forward to now. And we know that Venezuela has the world's largest oil reserves. And it seems as though it became a curse after a while, because whenever there's a lot of oil, there's a lot of greedy people that want it, and they destabilize the government. So what can the diaspora do to bring stability to Venezuela at this point?
Well, I think the diaspora, the Venezuelan diaspora, is learning very quickly that the democracy cannot stand without conversation. A democracy cannot stand without all of us being part of the nation and sitting down and discussing what we want for the nation. The tradition, the Latin American tradition of trying to eliminate your political opponent cannot stand. Like, that's not a way of constructing a democracy nor a republic. So in the diaspora, we have also because Venezuelans were so isolated from political struggle in terms of having to do that exercise of sitting down with your political opponent and talking it over, you know, getting to some consensus, getting to some arrangements. Because we were not accustomed to do that, we have been put in some democracies like the United States, like Colombia, like Spain, in which we there's a part of the population, Venezuelan population, that is very naive in terms of local politics and how that local politics influenced Venezuela.
Yeah, you know, so it's the same thing like the United States. You'll have a lot of people that say, oh, I don't get involved in politics. But when you don't get involved in politics, this is what happens.
Well, you're always involved in politics.
That's right. From the womb to the tomb, I tell people all the time, from the diaper you wear to the box they bury you in, it is political. But here's the thing. The United States is now showing a force there, because I know their ships are lining up in the waters right off of Trinidad. And the Venezuelan crisis, whether people believe it or not, has led to a major refugee crisis, and with millions, not thousands, but millions of people are fleeing Venezuela, and it's destabilizing neighboring countries. Do you support some sort of intervention from the United States, not war, but like you say, conversation, communication, collaboration with the government there to say, hey, it's time to stop this nonsense?
I think it's the only way forward in terms of like being able to get to a stable political situation. Like, you cannot, like, first, the option of military, you know, a military option is completely erroneous. It's a mistake, because, and I, you know, I love Venezuela. I love the United States. They're both my nations. I think it would be a huge mistake for the United States to try to mobilize militarily to Venezuela. It's not that, you know, they wouldn't, you know, quote unquote, win. It's just that it would create more problems.
More destruction. It'll destroy so many people and their homes and the country.
And more animosity. Like, the rest of Latin America will not see it as a friendly gesture. Like, none of the countries in around are actually asking or have suggested that option. So that's a no-brainer. But dialogue, yes. There's other ways of pressuring the government inside. And certainly there are political moves that can be made. Like, we just had recently a politician canonized as a Nobel Prize winner. She can be a very powerful source of change. Of course, I would ask her to, you know, also be on the right side of history in the United States. For example, when we have Venezuelans being deported without due process in the United States, she has to stand with Venezuelans. She cannot be standing with a government that is doing, you know, deportations without due process.
Yeah.
And that's a tricky thing.
Yeah, and I think the United States has a moral obligation to have talks, to communicate and speak with the regular Venezuelan on the street, the ones who will tell you about the devastating humanitarian crisis, the severe shortages of food, water, medicine, milk. People can't raise their children. I mean, and the United States and other countries sent millions of dollars to Venezuela. But where did that money go? And how come the people are still not seeing an improvement in their lives? I agree with you. I think the military buildup that we're seeing right now on the waters right off of the coast there, it should be that it's frightening. But I think peace through strength is a good thing, even if they see it and say, okay, let's talk. But it always bothers me why these governments don't speak with the actual people on the street. They will tell you exactly how they're suffering. There is no middle class in Venezuela. It's either the very rich or the poor. I think there is. Do you agree that the middle class is kind of eroded at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. Like that's one of the reasons my art focuses on the circulation of money, because that condemned middle class in Venezuela. Like the middle class in Venezuela, properly speaking, started with the petroleum industry and the engineers and the people that were involved with the petroleum industry. And those people, you know, basically fled. They left Venezuela around, I would say, 2006, when there was a petroleum strike. I think it was 2001, actually, 2001 to 2003, and they were fired by the then president Chavez. And once they were fired from the industry, they fled the country to get incorporated in other petroleum industries around the world.
Yeah, gotcha. So we have one minute left, and I know that you're an advocate for the LGBTQ community, there's a lot of issues. Can you quickly address that in a minute about the experiences that the queer community is having there in Venezuela as well?
Well, the queer community in Venezuela has a double-edged sword. It exists with some recognized rights that have been actually promulgated by the Chavez regime, and that in paper is great, but culturally and socially, the country has not changed a bit in terms of repression and isolation of the LGBT community in Venezuela. So it's a double-edged sword in that sense. It's a recognition in one sense, but in another, a lot of cultural isolation and confrontation.
Yeah. So take the last 20 seconds and tell our listeners why you want change in Venezuela right now.
I want change in Venezuela because I think Venezuelans need to learn how to build the country for all and not for, just people related to one industry, the petroleum industry. I think that's what we deserve. We deserve democracy. We are one of the first nations in the continent to create a republic and have a stable democracy, and I think we deserve it back.
Yeah, and if somebody wanted to reach you to see your works, do you have a website or some way of us contact? So give us your website, and I just want to tell our listeners, we are so grateful that we had Juan Herrera, who is a photographer, a Venezuelan-American, a multimedia artist, a writer and educator, and boy, what a great philosophical guy you are as well. Philosophy, you could be almost, you are like a one-stop shop, a man of everything. So give us your website.
Yes, my website is juanherrera.art, You can look me up on Instagram, on Facebook with the same name, Juan Herrera Art. And I actually next weekend will have a conversation here in my studio in Los Angeles with an economist about
Venezuela. It's been a great segment, but